Good Saturday morning to everybody from the Daniel Davis Deep Dive Intel Briefing, where we give you the best of what we learned this week, as well as some things we've learned overnight, as it turns out. Want to make sure you don't miss any of the important things here. And there was a lot that happened this week, and I want to catch you up on that. But first of all, I want to bring you up to date on something that happened overnight, just since our last regular show, and that is President Trump talking about how he sees this Russia-Ukraine war actually coming to an end.
I met with President Zelensky, as you know, today, and we had a very good meeting, very cordial meeting. In my opinion, they should stop the war immediately. You go by the battle line, wherever it is, otherwise it's too complicated. You'll never be able to figure it out. You stop at the battle line, and both sides should go home, go to their families, stop the killing, and that should be it. Stop right now at the battle line. I told that to President Zelensky. I told it to President Putin. Thank you very much, everybody.
Okay. Where to start? So his plan now is to just say, you know what? Where the current line of conflict is, this just stop. Everybody just finish what they're doing. Just stop shooting and go home to your families and problem solved. Everything will be over. And I mean, you know, some people have been trying to draw analogies over the week between, and Zelensky actually in the meeting with Trump yesterday did the same, to where they're trying to compare what he did with the Israeli Hamas situation and bringing the ceasefire into effect with what can happen here. And in that case, even at the time, and I think I've said it several times throughout the, you know, since that time, since the ceasefire went into effect, is that, okay, you've got phase one. It's a ceasefire and a hostage exchange. That's all that's happened so far. None of the issues in phase two, which is where all the thorny issues are, have even been negotiated. They haven't even started talking yet. So to say there is peace in the Middle East and it's over is a gross mischaracterization or a lack of understanding of actually what did happen there. And now it seems like that Trump himself is starting to go, you know what, that worked over there. Maybe he's convinced himself that there's actually peace there in the Middle East. And so he's going to go, we'll do the same thing here. All he wants to do is just to have stop the shooting. There's a word for that. It's called a ceasefire. That's what he tried to get in Alaska. You may recall, not very much successful. The Russians were having none of it. Of course, they said that under no circumstances will we agree to an unconditional ceasefire because that would reward our opponents and it would harm our military offensive. We're going to keep the pressure on, but we're happy to negotiate. We desire to negotiate. We will continue to, and we'll talk about all these difficult issues, but only if the core fundamentals that went into the cause of the war, the root causes, as they use that phrase, only if those things are addressed and solved, and then we'll have a ceasefire. And that's kind of what this is asking for. It's kind of a redux, and they're just putting different packaging on it. Just stop fighting. You see that in that telling that Trump has mentioned there, there is none of the root causes talked about. And listen, let's first of all start off on the Western side. Europe and Ukraine would never agree to that. I mean, they haven't already. No one is on the Western side, and I'm in this particular case, I say West meaning Europe and Ukraine, they're not even talking about freezing the line. The only analogy or the only way that Zelensky has even referred to anything along the line of contact is that's a good place to start the negotiation. So what they want is they do want the benefit of an immediate and unconditional ceasefire that only allows the start of negotiations on those issues. And he said the current line of contact, this is probably 2 months or more ago, the current line of contact is a good place to start that. So he would love that in terms of having a cessation of the hostilities, because then he would do everything that the Russians said that they won't agree to it because the Ukraine side would rearm. They would continue mobilization. They would strengthen their losses. They would improve their defenses. That's what they would do. They want to do that for the very reason to strengthen their side, to make it where they don't have to agree to any of the harder things there. That's why Russia, very practical, they won't agree to that. So in terms of what Trump's saying here, the Ukraine and the European side are not going to agree to that if you're talking about that just ending the war and that's it. That's the line of contact. That's the new division line. And everybody else just go home with none of the issues solved. So there seems to be very little evidence that Europe would agree to that, and Zelensky is categorically opposed to it. More on both of those in just a minute. But it also is clear that Russia's not going to agree to that. Russia's been fighting since 2022, and in their telling, since around the middle of the spring of 2014, when the civil war actually began, and they had begun helping the ethnic Russians in the eastern part of Ukraine, the Ukrainians that were living in eastern Ukraine, they were helping the Ukrainians against the Ukrainian government. So it was a civil war. Make sure you're clear on that. The Russian side, they said they were helping, and that's ultimately what they used as their claim anyway, that they went into Ukraine in February of 2022, was because the attacks were increasing from the Ukrainian military onto their ethnic brethren in the eastern part, and then they went in to help. And then Donetsk and Luhansk especially formed, or they had already militias, and then they all joined forces and they started this war that we have to this day. So Russia's not going to just say, okay, you know what, we'll just stop here. I know that we annexed these four territories. We wrote them into our constitution. We have always said for sure that we will always have them in fully integrated into the state of Russia, and will also ensure that before the end of hostilities, that there will be a change in the government on the Ukrainian side, so that our other ethnic Russian citizens who are living, especially east of the Dnieper River, but on the western side of the current four oblast areas, that they have some protections too, that the laws are changed to allow them to use their language, to give them limited autonomy, etc. So there's still some big ask for the Russia. There is no way on God's earth that the Russian people would allow their leader to agree to something like that, because they would view that as an unequivocal, just catastrophic loss. Because they have the power, the wherewithal, and they're more than well aware of the disparity between the balance of power. The things that go into war-making capability at the national level are irrevocably on their side. So for them, even if it takes a lot longer, and believe me, the Russian mentality is much more willing to let time play itself out if they have an advantage than we are. We want an answer today. We want to solve it right now, and we don't want to, I mean, we don't even think beyond the next election cycle, much less 5, 10-year, 15-year periods. In some cases, like the Chinese do, the Russians maybe are not quite that far down, but dang sure a lot further than we are. And they're like, this is, we don't like the pace of it. I've shown you many times here recently where people are complaining inside Russia at the pace of this. They do want it to pick up, because we're closing in on 4 years now. So that patience is starting to wear a bit, but that's in unhappiness at the pace of going forward. Now, if Putin were to agree to just stop it right there, I mean, they probably would revolt. He's aware of that, so they're never going to do that. So then that has to leave you then, where is this going to go? What does President Trump think is going to happen here? Because again, we talked about this just yesterday. You have a similar dynamic as what we had in the Anchorage, Alaska. A lot of fanfare. Trump said, yeah, I think we have this. We're going to get this solved. I think Putin wants to get it solved, and we're going to make it happen. And then nothing changed. They met personally in Anchorage, Alaska. There was supposed to be this bilateral meeting between Putin and Zelensky. Then there was going to be a trilat with adding Trump into it. Supposed to happen within weeks. And of course, it never happened. None of it happened, because neither Zelensky nor Putin ever changed their outcomes, their desires. And there's no reason to think that's going to happen here. So the question is going to be, what do we think is going to happen on the other side of this meeting here? And listen, let me show you something else that's also on the minds of both the Europeans and the Russians. And when they're talking about what Trump is. Now, I just mentioned the issue of Alaska, but here's some things just this week. Now, the issue of Tomahawks is something we covered a lot during the week, and I want to take you back to Monday, first of all, where Trump was very angry because the Russians hadn't agreed to end the war, and he said he might bring Tomahawks into it.
Do they want to have Tomahawks going in their direction? I don't think so. I think I might speak to Russia about that, in all fairness. I told that to President Zelensky, because Tomahawks are a new step of aggression. Right. You understand that very well.
Are
okay.
You saying that you will speak to Putin first about
and
Tomahawks?
I might talk to him. I might say, look, if this war's not going to get settled, I'm going to send them Tomahawks. I may say that. The Tomahawk is an incredible weapon, very offensive weapon. And honestly, Russia does not need that They don't need that. Yeah, I might tell them that if the war is not settled, that we may very well do it. We may not, but we may do it. I think it's appropriate to bring up. Yeah.
So catch the sequencing of there. So that's earlier this week when he said, yeah, if Russia doesn't agree to this, I may give them Tomahawks. It's a very offensive weapon, and it would change the tone. And they said, you've talked to Zelensky. Yeah, I've talked to Zelensky on this, and he had. And so Zelensky's hearing that and saying, yeah, exactly. Give me those Tomahawk missiles. Put pressure on Russia. That's what I've been asking for from the beginning. That's awesome. And then he's going to talk to Putin. He said in that clip, I'm going to talk to Putin and tell him that you have to negotiate this and you have to bring this to an end, or I may go ahead and allow Tomahawk missiles. So Zelensky's in town. They're in earlier part of this week. And he hears, like we did, that Trump has announced that he's going to, or was talking to Putin. So given that statement there, Zelensky's got to be thinking, he's reading him the Riot Act. And he's telling you either agree to terms that we want, or we're going to escalate by giving this capability to the Ukraine side. And then yesterday morning, on the same topic of Tomahawks, the president says this.
What's going to happen if the United States is in a conflict and we need the Tomahawks?
Do we have enough? That's a problem. We need Tomahawks and we need a lot of other things that we've been sending over the last 4 years to Ukraine. We've been, you know, we gave them a lot. Now we have a different situation. We send it to the European Union. They pay for it and all that, and they have plenty of money. But it's beyond the money. You know, we need Tomahawks, and we need a lot of other weapons that we're sending to Ukraine. One of the reasons we want to get this war over is exactly that. It's not easy for us to give. You're talking about massive numbers of very powerful weapons. So that's one of the things we'll be talking about.
So now he's just completely reversed course. Now that he's going, well, I mean, we got to have them too. I mean, we're not going to get rid of ours and other categories of weapons. Remember, Zelensky's arrow was specifically for two categories, air defense interceptor missiles and Tomahawks, long-range missiles. That was on his to-do list. That was what he was talking about. That's why he came to Washington. And he was led to believe by Trump himself that he was ready to read the Riot Act to Putin so that when they met in Washington, D.C. on Friday, then he was going to hopefully have some good news for him and say either Putin agreed to what I said, or here's your Tomahawks. And there was also some information around the middle of the week where American media leaked out that, well, the administration is apparently preparing and maybe has already decided to give between 20 and 50 Tomahawk missiles. So he's reading that. I can assure you, I'm sure he's using some of his sources. And one might imagine that they're telling him the same thing, that, yeah, you could probably get around 50 of them, et cetera. And we talked about how 50 is not going to change anything, and not a war at the national level, even if they get through, and most of them won't, but it's, whatever gets through is not going to change anything. So it was a pathetically small number. It's not going to change anything. But for Zelensky, it's the image of having the Tomahawk missile. So he would like, all right, we'll start with 50 and figure it out from there. And then all of a sudden he goes to this meeting after Putin and Trump had talked on the phone, and Trump has now radically changed the whole tone of the conversation. And you can go back and watch our show yesterday where we showed a couple of clips from inside that meeting where all the cameras were. And when they showed Zelensky, he was totally flummoxed because he just got the rug pulled out from under him. That's the opposite of what he had prepared to come in there for. And now he's got to try and figure out, you know, what's next. Well, it got worse after we did our show yesterday. So, and I think Gary actually came on just before the end of the show and told everybody we were expecting, and he had already alerted me ahead of the show, that there was a plan, as there almost always is when a foreign dignitary meets, after they have the private meeting, you know, they do the camera thing there like they did here, whether in the Oval or in that long conference table. And then they have a private meeting, and then they come out and they have a couple of podiums and microphones set up there, whatever, and the two leaders talk basically about whatever they discussed in private. And that was all set up and it was supposed to happen. But then all of a sudden they said, nope, there's not going to be one. There won't be anyone. So there's not going to be a conversation in the White House like there always was. Apparently Trump just left. And so then the report was that we got right at the end of the show was Zelensky left. Well, as it turns out, he didn't completely leave, but he was not even allowed to give a press briefing from inside the White House. And instead, and what you're about to see here, they sent him across the street. And you see, I mean, the imagery here is, you can't miss this, man. It is on the outside of the White House. It is outside of the barricades. And so it's physically blocked off. And he is, just so you know, it's where the tourists go. It's where tourists go to look at the White House. It's in a park that's right outside of the White House there. And he has been relegated to just going in the park. And the cold outside the White House is such an analogy here. And you're going to see this on his face. And you're going to see he has a hard time even putting sentences together.
Spoke about here in the past, and it's important for us. You know, we decided that we will work more with productions, try to manage how to change the order of one country, which systems are already with our order, so it's a difficult process. In any way, this, I think, positive signal that we will work on it. We understand the number, what we need, and we understand where to get it. And it's a pity we understand the challenges, how to get it. Yeah, we spoke about the house. I'm open with it. We want very much. Yes, and the president already, I think, that American side said that, look, we have to understand because we don't have, I mean, this. We need that. And this is the position of Americans for today. But nobody, I mean, this, nobody canceled this dialogue, this topic. Yes, so we just, we have to work on it. More.
Man, the first, sometimes it's hard to understand what he's saying. And the first half of the skip, he's talking about the air defense missiles and the Patriots. And so he said, yeah, it's really difficult. You know, we're trying to figure a way out of that because he was meeting with a lot of the defense contractors who make the missiles, et cetera. And he's saying, you know, maybe one of the things we can do is some of the orders that the U.S. had that were ready to deliver to other customers, they can divert to us, and then the ones that they would make for us would then later on go back to them. But that's really complicated. So what that tells you, even in air defense missiles, they're going to get a couple of handfuls, nothing close to being able to protect the skies in Ukraine. Well, there's no difference. Make sure you understand that. Even in air defense missiles, nothing's going to change. It's going to continue to be really difficult. But then in the second part of that, then he said, yeah, we talked about Tomahawk missiles. And this is where the body language betrays what really the words were coming out of his mouth, what was really inside. Because you see, when Zelensky is talking and he's confident, when we've shown you some of these, like when he's in comfortable territory in the European Union, and you see him making these statements, and he's in front of this big audience. He is looking right at the camera. He is talking here. He's looking at the audience there, and he is locked in, and he is just hitting point after point after point, and he's very clear on what he wants. In this big clip here, in that second part on the Tomahawks, he's stammering. He's trying. You see a couple of times he'll pause and trying to figure out, because what we said, and you can see him catching himself in mid-sentence going, okay, well, I can't say that. I can't make Trump mad, but I also can't admit that there's not going to be any Tomahawks. So he's trying to dance around it. He's not looking at the camera. He's looking down. I mean, some of the classic things that you're trying to figure out what not to say and how to avoid getting into any further trouble. But no question about it, you're not going to get those Tomahawk missiles. And that had to be incredibly clear. There was no question on his face there about, well, there's a shot, we'll get them. You know, if these or that thing happens, et cetera. No, there's no. He said, well, the situation was still open and we didn't shut it off and the conversation will continue on. That's what he wants. If we were ever going to give Tomahawk missiles, it would have been now. The time was perfect. Trump had it set up in the first of the week. He had been having conversations with Zelensky and his entourage. They were in town. They were talking to all these people. Trump himself led Zelensky to believe that he was going to read the riot act to Putin. And instead, it seemed like it was nearly the other way around. Now, whether Putin doesn't read the riot act to other heads of state, that's not his style, but he does. And they had it. Listen, it was a 2.5 hour phone call that they had. So they talked about a lot of stuff, Trump and Putin did. And Putin is really good at reading Trump. And he's really good at using the language that he needs. And obviously, he's got over his shoulder here the largest nuclear arsenal in the world. So that kind of gives you some credibility all by itself. And if you're also talking to Trump in ways that he can receive, it can sound really flattering and rational. And so that's kind of where we ended up with that. And, you know, I don't know what the Europeans are going to do. We do know that they recognized everything I just told you. And in fact, German Chancellor Friedrich Merz was reported afterwards as saying, okay, well, that didn't work out very well. Gary, if you can put that full screen up there of Friedrich Merz. So he says, this is the quote here. This is in Ukrainska Pravda. Said the visit has not gone as Zelensky had hoped. I think I can say that here. Well, that's a pretty big understatement. But then you see they continued on. Merz added that this makes Europe's support even more essential, as the war can only end if Ukraine maintains its military strength. He stated that he would continue working to support Ukraine financially, politically, and of course, militarily. Merz stressed that surrender is not an option for Ukraine, warning that if it capitulates, Russia will attack another European country next. And so you see that the European sides were so caught flat-footed, they didn't have any expectation this was going to happen. And they're saying, yeah, we'll continue on going with that. And listen, they can't. But then that gets back to that first clip I showed you. They're not going to just say, yeah, in the war where it's at, because then they've accomplished nothing. Russia has accomplished all this stuff. Even in the Western European, if the Russians would consider it an absolute loss and potentially revolt against Putin for agreeing to what Trump said, even the Europeans on their side of the line are going, no way, man, because in their view, that would reward Russia and they would get to keep all of that stuff. And that's anathema to them. And they say, no, we're going to continue to support Ukraine. They're not going to agree to it either. So then we are back to square one. Where is this going? This is what is today. This is the October the 18th. President Trump came into office on the 20th of January saying he was going to get this solved in a day. And now here we are 9 full months later, and he is right back to square one with no plan. And there's no place that this is going to go any place that's good. So, yikes. Don't expect any kind of breakthroughs in here. I mean, this is there's supposed to be, and what's still on the table, it's important to mention this. There's supposed to be a ministerial level, high level conversation sometime potentially this week with Sergei Lavrov and Secretary of State Marco Rubio. And they're contingent somewhere where they're going to try and find some kind of an end to this. And then if there's anything good from there, then there's going to be in Budapest, Hungary, a visit between Putin and Trump. That second one is not scheduled, and it will only happen if both Trump and Putin and potentially Zelensky actually agree to something in this ministerial. And as you can see here, the two sides are very, very far apart. And Trump called himself the mediator. So this is going to happen between three presidents, president of Russia, president of America, and president of Ukraine. I'm the mediator president, so he says. You can't be a mediator if you're supplying one with lethal military aid against the other. It's not a mediator. You can say that in your own mind if you want to be that, because you are trying to bring the sides together, but you're not neutral. You are very much militarily aligned on the one side here. So that's not going to be really well received in the Russian side. And they certainly don't view it as that way, though they do recognize that, thank goodness that President Trump is at least willing to have these conversations, as his predecessor only talked about supporting forever and literally wouldn't even talk to his counterpart. So better for that. But listen, there's, as the thing sits right here today on Saturday, there is no more hope that this leads to a breakthrough, and that if even these ministerial meetings happen between Lavrov and Rubio next week, I'm not even convinced that's for sure going to happen, because, I mean, you've got to have, you know, some kind of common ground even there so that you've got something close to try and negotiate here. And based on what the two sides are saying, the other two sides, the belligerents, the Russian and the Ukraine/European side, I mean, they're still like out of the screen, far apart. So I'm hopeful that and I'm encouraging it. I hope they have the meeting anyway. But until one side or the other, and by that I only mean the Ukraine side, recognizes that the balance of power is irrevocably on the Russian side, and they are not going to give in to their core requirements, this war will simply continue on, and the bloodshed will continue, the losses will continue, and the destruction of Ukrainian cities will continue. That's where we are. That's the reality of it. That wasn't the only thing that happened this week. I want to talk to you about a couple other things. We had some great shows this week, really some interesting observations by some of our guests. Really was happy the way this week turned out. Next one I want to look at here is Ian Proud, who's actually kind of talked about some of the issues. He's a former British diplomat, was assigned to the embassy in Moscow for a number of years, so has really good insight into how the Russians think and how they view things. And in that, he provided some context to how the Russians are actually viewing this issue and whether they will or won't agree to something Trump wants.
From the Russian perspective, you know, they're happy with this slow grinding progress because actually they're not fighting for land, they're fighting for time. They know that the Europeans are running out of money to keep bankrolling Zelensky, and all they need to do is to have a fairly static campaign, making small probes here and there, just gradually bleeding Europe dry of cash. This is no longer really about Ukraine. It's really about sort of, you know, Europe slowly imploding upon itself as it tries to keep the war going. I think that is the real sort of fight in Putin's mind. He's fighting with time and he's in no hurry to launch any big conventional offensive. He's happy to sit by and watch. So that's what makes Zelensky's gamble such a gamble, because he now wants to kind of go two steps up the escalation ladder, which is what the Tomahawk issue would represent. And that's why I don't think Trump will agree.
And yeah, he's not wrong there. The Russians recognize, I mean, they've calculated this disparity between the balance of power. They know that that is irrevocably on their side. They know that the West can't match it up. Listen, if at nearing the 4-year mark of this war, the best that the West can do cumulatively is that they produce in the key weapon systems and armaments somewhere around in a year, roughly what the Russians can do in a 3 to 4 month period. If it's still that disparity on the production, meaning what rolls off the assembly line and what even can go to the front, if there's still that much disparity, folks, it's not going to change fundamentally, probably ever. Because even these increases that are coming now, many of them are still in the process and are a year or two away from coming to maturation. So there'll be some incremental changes here, but there's no one's even talking about yet more fundamental increases of substance on top of what's already been planned and resourced. So you're going to get this, you know, slow ramp up, and it may get up to here. Problem is, Russia's also in the process of accelerating. They didn't stop here. They're still building up here. So whatever incremental you're going to get here, it'll keep going like this. Because the other side is doing the same. They haven't stopped at all, because many in Russia believe that this is only a precursor and that there's a good chance that they end up fighting NATO. We can argue all day that that's not going to happen, or we certainly don't want it to happen, but the Russians aren't taking any chances, and they're preparing and building up arsenals as though it were going to happen. So that means that you're never going to catch up. So you heard that Ian Proud is right there. And from the Russian side, they do absolutely think time is on their side. And that's one of the big differences between Putin and many of the Russians, is that they say, we see the weakening on the front line here. There's no reason not to just crush it with weight and power, you know, find a weak portion of the line somewhere and then flood it. And yeah, you're going to have high casualties at the point of penetration, but then after that, you can roll them up from the inside. Many have been saying that inside Russia. I've wondered for more than a year why Russia hasn't done that. They could have, in my view, brought this war to a conclusion a lot longer ago. But whatever, they have chosen not to, because Putin, even though a lot of people talk about him being Hitler and, you know, evil and all this, he's very risk averse. And he continues to tell Trump, as he did at this just a couple of days ago in their phone call, they want to have a relationship with the West. They want to have a relationship with the United States that's beneficial and mutually beneficial to each side and positive. So that's not the guy you want to get out of power, because there are plenty of people in Russia who want to have nothing to do with the West, who want to sever the lines, look everything to the East and to the global South, et cetera, and just say, we're going to consider this a hostile block, and then go forward. There's a lot that want that. So be careful what you wish for. If you didn't have Putin in there, you could have something a lot better. But the point here for today is that Putin is still in charge, and so far he is maintaining his risk-averse nature with the recognition that time is on his side, and even if it takes a lot longer, and Peter the Great, by the way, who's somebody he's referenced in just the past week or so, did take a long time to win some of his military victories. So that kind of gives you an insight, I think, into the mentality of Putin, but he's a good calculator. He does math pretty well, and he can see that this stuff is just, it's not going to go backwards on him. And he has this arsenal that in the event that there is some kind of setback, he can really escalate and ramp things up on the ground inside of Ukraine. We also had Dr. Lyle Goldstein, a former, he's currently works at of Asia Studies, the director of Asia Studies at Defense Priorities, but was also for 20 years a professor at the Naval War College, so has some really good credentials in that. He also said, listen, Russia could take a peace deal that might come at a high cost, but even absent this, he says Russia still has what it takes to win.
Russia wants more. They want a clean victory, and they're not that far from that. So that is kind of tantalizing, I'm sure, for President Putin. But on the other hand, they know that to reach that kind of state where they're in a kind of the clean victory, where they get everything they want, a full loaf, if you will, would still be incredibly costly and also quite risky, let's face it. So because a lot can go wrong between now and then. But let's talk about Kharkiv and Kherson for a minute. And I would just say, if the White House is serious about stopping the war, then put those on the table. Say, President Putin, you can sacrifice 100,000 soldiers to get these two cities, or you can have them now. But if you're going to have them now, we are going to have to come to agreement now.
Yeah. So, you know, Lyle was saying, look, this Russia can do some things, but there's some things we can offer them. Basically, and he said this, by the way, before Trump made that comment that we just showed you just from last night. So this came before Trump said that, but he is essentially saying they're not, you know, the Russians aren't just going to accept the deal at the line of contact. They have the power to demand more, and they're simply not going to do it. And he said, if the West is serious, and the White House probably should listen to this part, if you even want to make it difficult on Russia, at this ministerial meeting that's coming up there, that's where they should put on the table to say, we are willing, and that means Zelensky, meaning twist his arm behind his back if you have to say, yeah, we'll give in on all of the stuff in the Donbass, all of it. And, you know, and then you can try to keep some in the southern part. I don't think that Russia would agree to that, but make it hard on them. Say, all right, we're willing to give this up to show that you're at least willing to acknowledge reality and understand that you're not going to end it at the line of contact, which is what Trump said he wanted. But if we're serious about it, they're going to have to do some more because Russia just has the capacity to do this. Now, one of the false hopes that many in the West continue to have, whether that's Emmanuel Macron, Jack Keane has been really big on saying this later, General Ben Hodges, retired General Ben Hodges, they've been just preaching this nonstop all the day. But that, look, Russia is a paper tiger. Trump said this the other couple of weeks ago. He said it because he's listening to these people in all likelihood. And they look and they see on the ground, they look at a map and they just look at the map and they go, man, look, in the last 2 years, Russia's only taken 1% additional of Ukraine. So they have a little over 20% or so. But yeah, so they're not that good, man. If that's all they can take in all this time, yeah, they're not that good. But as Colonel Jacques Beau told us earlier this week and reiterated here again, that is a misunderstanding of what the Russian objectives are.
Ukraine has not understood that you can win a war even if you go backwards. It's not about territory. The aim is to destroy the forces. And that's exactly the doctrine of the Russians. By using maneuver warfare, that's exactly, for instance, what the Russians have done in the Kharkov region in September 2022. When the Ukrainians counterattacked there, the Russians could anticipate that movement and they withdrew even before being in contact with the Ukrainians. So the Ukrainians came into an empty area. They were bombed by the Russian artillery. The Russians could withdraw in good order without having contact with the enemy. And that's exactly the way you win this kind of war. And but the Russians have been expert in this kind of things. The Ukrainian enter the space, you destroy them with artillery, aircraft, flying bombs, and whatever. And then you save the life of your own troops. And that's, if you look carefully at what has happening since 2023, I mean, in fact, October 2022, the Russians have been consistently doing that, thus killing Ukrainians for nothing, basically.
So therein is your important issue. And he said also on our show in previous episodes that he cited the statement by General Surovikin in 2022 that that was the objective of the Ukraine, of the Russian armed forces. They have expressly said that. Demilitarization, as I keep using that phrase, by the Russian side, that's what they mean. They mean it will either be accomplished at the negotiating table, like a Treaty of Versailles that limited the German army to 100,000. There would be some similar kind of thing here at the negotiating table, that the entire Ukrainian armed forces would be basically restricted to a defense force, a border defense force of 100,000 or something like that. I think 85,000 was the number that was pitched around a year or so ago. But that's what the Russians are saying. Or they'll do method number two, which is the destruction. And there has been some analysis done that's credible, I think, on the front line. In some of these places, like where Russia makes big breakthroughs, and I even covered this earlier this summer around Pokrovsk, where there was a big breakthrough. And I said, well, okay, this could be it. This could be where they finally make a penetration of the line and pour in lots of exploitation forces and roll the whole thing up from the inside. That's what I thought was entirely possible here. And then it didn't happen. And there are estimates in that one of the reasons it didn't happen is because Russia chose not to send the exploitation forces in there. Because you ought to understand, when that penetration happened north of Pokrovsk, it was a penetration. They did break through the last line of defensive fortifications that Ukraine had. If Russia had rolled troops into there, there was no fortifications left, and it would have been a turkey shoot. So they could have gone through there, but they chose not to. And apparently the reason why, and I've seen some analysts that said that Russians basically stayed in that one penetration there, and then they invited the Ukraine side to bring in, they did, their strategic reserves into that area. And I've shown you many times on the map where they used those reserves to try and block that penetration. The Russians held firm on those points, and they had some impact on some portions, and then it went back out. They tried to cut off this long penetration, the northern spike, if you will. That didn't work, and then the Russians replaced recovered those losses. Each time all of these reserves comes in, they keep getting destroyed. And according to some of the Ukraine Telegram channels that I followed, the casualties have been extraordinarily high on the Ukraine side. And that appears to be the reason. That appears to be the plan, is that they want a penetration to draw the reserves in and then methodically destroy the reserves. And so all along, whether you're talking Kupiansk, whether you're talking Pokrovsk, whether you're talking in the Zaporizhia area, or even now up in the Kharkiv area, there's been additional penetrations up on the front. So those fronts have gotten a little bit hotter here in recent weeks. And all along this line of contact, Russia keeps killing more and more Ukrainians by prioritizing firepower above maneuver. So they're not trying primarily to take territory, but they are doing a lot to accelerate and increase the casualty rate on the Ukraine side, and they are not using troops to go in and try to take this area, which minimizes their own casualties. And whatever you want to read, and I've got it on very high authority, I'll just tell you that the casualties that many toss around on the Russian side of 1.5 million dead is nothing but pure fiction to make it sound like we need to keep going because we're trying to a war of attrition against the Russian side. There's no truth to it at all. They're not small. It is very painful, and especially in the first year and a half of the war, Russia did have a very high casualty rate as they kind of learned how to what their tactics were going to be and how to change their operational maneuver, et cetera, to protect their force, minimize the losses, but accelerate and maximize the death on the other side. That's what they have chosen to do, and I've got it from two separate sources that are well-connected. I'll just leave it at that, both of them have said nearly the same thing, that it's a very low number per month of killed in action on the Russian side. Would be pretty painful by our standards here, but it's not a fraction of what the reports are on the Ukraine side. So I think that our guests this week were right, that time is on Russia's side. They recognize that, and there's very little chance that they're going to give in to what's going on. One last thing I do want to talk about here before we let you off, it was also learned this week, and that is this situation in Venezuela. There was some more information out overnight that there are about 10,000 now U.S. troops in the region, and that's warships and air power and even some ground power with some Marines. Those numbers keep going up, increasing the concern that the U.S. may be going to do something on the ground inside of Venezuela. We also had a report by President Trump himself admitting that he had authorized CIA to conduct covert operations inside Venezuela. And let me just tell you, that is a bad move. There is nothing beneficial to the United States that this is going to do anything except potentially spark another regional war that we can't win. It could get us bogged down and then would require even more troops that could result in killed in action. None have so far, not of ours. It's also breaking law, American law and international law, because we are summarily executing people who are accused of running drugs. There was some information out that some of these were not Venezuelans, some were Colombians, and some were fishing people just out fishing. They were not running drugs at all. We don't know any of those. All we have is the claim from the White House that we have deep, deep intelligence. So the president said that that's going on, that that's that this is something that's good. But even if he was right, that still violates international law. That still gets us potentially in the situation where we could end up in a conflict with another country. And unless you have, unless Venezuela has gone to war with America, unless Venezuela is about to attack America, and I mean attack, not defend themselves from, but unless those two things are happening, it is against the United States Constitution for the president of the United States, whoever it may be, to take action against another sovereign country. Trump has already violated that in Iran. We've talked about that a lot. And if, and it's already illegal for what we've done with these boats, but if we go into Venezuela here too, then that is yet another violation of our own laws, 1973 War Powers Act and the U.S. Constitution. And folks, that's a bad, bad deal. And the more we shred the rule of law, which is meant to protect us, it's not meant to inhibit us. And when done properly, you can provide fully for your national security needs. You can provide fully for the economic prosperity for your people and stay within the rule of law, which keeps you on the moral high ground to actually have influence on others around the world who are not following the rule of law or who are not doing things according to even their own constitution. We have leverage against them. When we do this, we forfeit that leverage. We lower our own moral foundation, and then we increase the chance that we could get sucked into yet another war that has no clear objectives, no path to success, and will end up harming our interests, not helping it. And I pray that the saner voices finally start to carry the day there, or that the president recognizes this is a dead end and someplace we should not go down to. But like all of these issues, you can count on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive to keep you updated, because we are unintimidated and uncompromised to bring you the truth, whatever it is. We're always focused on that, and we're going to continue to do it. Also, as a reminder, I know a lot of you love to watch our shows, and we're so grateful for you to do that. But I know that some of you have friends that aren't big video watchers, but they do love podcasts. Please let them know that we are on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podcast Addict, anywhere you get your podcasts. Just type in Daniel Davis Deep Dive, and they'll find us there. And for your other friends who like to get their information on the written form, and lots of people like it in different places, DanielDavisDeepDive.substack.com, and you can find us there as well. And so we've got something for everybody. Don't hold this to yourself, folks. We want to maximize this message because, you know, unlike the mainstream media, we're not subject to the pressures that may come from above or from investors or from other kinds of people who have an incentive and a motivation to change their coverage, etc. We don't have that here. So you get the truth. And it's not even unvarnished truth. We varnish it up for you real good to put it in context. That's why we have the literal name Daniel Davis Deep Dive. So we're going to continue doing that for you. And we will look very much forward to seeing you with another great set of shows next week on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.